Welcome to the Million Vegan Grandmothers podcast, and I'm honored to have Corey Davis back with me. Welcome, Corey.
Hey, Tammy, it's such a pleasure to be back.
Oh, I was just at an amazing presentation that Corey gave to some climate activists, and he packed a lot of information. So I would love for that presentation to be maybe on our YouTube channel at some point. So, Corey, what have you been up to since the last time I've talked to you a few months ago? I know that you're going to be on our Convergence doing a presentation on April 28th, this year.
Yeah, well, for me, it's been business as usual. I did quite a few presentations in between then and now. So I did put my mind towards watershed security in the broader context of North America, British Columbia, and have been thinking about that certainly in light of the droughts that have been occurring and are forecasted for this year as well.
Right. Well, we had a very dry winter here in Alberta. We hardly had any precipitation. We're getting quite a bit right now in Calgary, but it's been incredibly dry here. So we'll see what happens. We will learn to be more conservative with water, that's for certain. And we do know the way we eat has the largest contribution of whether we're going to dry out our lands or not.
That's right. And I was looking at Statistics Canada the other day and I was upset. It said industry is the leading driver of water consumption in Canada, which they include things like dams. So of course, hydroelectric power is a big user of water in Canada, but it goes back into the where the water originates from, right? Its natural source. Take it from the ground and you put it back. So I did write Statistics Canada. At first, I was a bit upset, and then I was like, "Well, maybe I'll just reach out to them and ask them about it a little bit more, and just put it out there that agriculture is the lead consumer of water, meaning that it withdraws water from the natural environment, and it doesn't end back, or it doesn't end up back in its original source, right? So that's the difference between water use and water consumption. Water use is kind of this umbrella term. It means any withdrawals from a water body, regardless if you're putting it back or not. Whereas water consumption is where you remove it from the water body, but it doesn't go back to its original source. Of course, most of the water withdrawn from agriculture ends up being evaporated out of corn stalks or what have you. So I wrote them, and I didn't really expect much of a response back, but when they responded just a couple days later, I noticed immediately the web page was updated to industry as the lead user of water. But agriculture is the lead consumer of water. Something that when I think about droughts, I always put my mind to, and that how can we make agriculture more efficient in that way? Not just so we have water in our homes, but for the ecosystems that suffer, you know. In the United States, there's a paper that came out a few years ago noting that livestock farming, cattle for feed, so and dairy, so the beef and dairy industry is the lead driver of water consumption in the Western United States region, and the leading driver of water shortages and fish imperilment. It's not just about human access to water, it's about the ecosystems that the water accommodates. I like
Yeah.
how the BC First Nation Assembly of First Nations puts it, that water is the blood of Mother Earth. And I like that. I like that kind of framing. Sometimes when we talk about the environment and impacts, we tend to be so scientifically focused that we lose that human connection. And I think that when we poeticize nature in such a way, it speaks to the soul in a sense. So
Yeah.
I always embrace that.
Always about the poetry, right? It just kind of hits something deep.
That's right.
Geordie today on a podcast was reading some ancient poetry of what were known as mystics and spiritual teachers that were definitely vegan by the words in their poetry. And as you're speaking, I'm thinking about a documentary that really hit deep into me. It was done by a Maori man. The documentary is called Melkt. And it was done in New Zealand, and New Zealand isn't a very large country, but it has a very high dairy industry. And he was showing that there was no clean water anymore to swim in. The lakes were polluted, the rivers were polluted. So not just a heavy consumption of these dairy cattle, but also they were polluting all the aquifers, all the lakes, all the rivers. And they said that even if they wanted to start making plant-based milk, there wasn't enough clean water to even try to get a good plant-based milk production. So
No.
this is a big deal. And I don't know why we wouldn't want to know this. We wouldn't want to be running and, you know, speaking at the headwaters of the blood of Mother Earth everywhere, you know, protesting that we stop not just consuming, but the amount of pollution going on. So, and you know, as we're speaking about this, you know, I was praying with the 22 prayers of the grandmothers that gather together on the 22nd of every month, and it was World Water Day on the 22nd. So it's a great opportunity for us to. I remember growing up and my dad, like, I never leave the water running when I brush my teeth. I'm so conservative. When I have a bath, I keep the water. I use it to flush the toilet. But you know, that is just a drop in the bucket. If you watch the documentary Cowspiracy by Kip Anderson, who actually just has a brand new documentary, Christspiracy, that just came out, he shows that it's, you know, 660 gallons up to 1,000 gallons for one hamburger, to make one hamburger of water. So, yeah, if we're going to
Quite
celebrate.
water intensive, that's right.
Well, thank you, Corey. Now, what, since we're on the topic of water and we just crossed World Water Day, what are some of the games that we play and the stories we tell that aren't helpful when it comes to allowing our ecosystems and their water sources to heal? What are the games that we play, the stories we tell that do not allow that? And what are the things that we do, that we're doing now, that we're putting into place that will be a new story that we're going to be able to tell our grandchildren?
That's a really difficult question, Tammy, but I appreciate it because it's going to make me think really hard. What we tell about water. Well, one of the things that I always kind of reflect on is my perspective of the land is fleeting. I might have said this in our podcast earlier, but I was speaking with somebody who works with an Indigenous nation, and he was trying to convey to me something. I haven't s stayed in a place for the past 20 years, more than a few years. I move around a lot. I think I'm connected to nature. I do try so hard to get out into nature and understand nature and watch it. It's something that always draws me in. But my perspective of the land is fleeting. I'll never really know what it's like to live on a place that my mom lived on, that her mom lived on, and so on for generations since time immemorial, pretty much. And that kind of intergenerational knowledge over time builds not just our own knowledge set, but it builds cultures that bloom out of that place. Something that I always want to think about on myself. When we look at land and when we build conservation management strategies. I just sat in on a watershed security strategy meeting. We're always thinking about the now. We don't often get a chance to reflect on the past and what led to where we are at today, right? We kind of think of nature as what it is now, and we accept nature in its current state as it is now. We accept that to be nature, which does impact our conservation baselines. They call it the shifting baseline syndrome. As the environment degrades over time, each successive generation understands the current state to be the norm. And we accept nature in its current state as the norm. But in doing so, we're neglecting the power of ecosystem services that once thrived there, you know, albeit water storage, water filtration, flood protection, erosion control, all things that many of us today fear, certainly Drought makes me very uncomfortable. The thought of flooding makes me very uncomfortable. And I often wonder and ponder what could have been. And I try to address that cognitive bias. Maybe I'll call it a shifting baseline syndrome, a cognitive bias. I don't know if that's right, but try and address that and think about not just how the world is today, but what it was in the past and what it could be in the future, right? We are at a crossroads where there's tremendous amounts of opportunity in front of us and serious consequences, if we don't act. And so I think that's one of the things that we tell us that skews the way we view the world is always accepting the current state of nature as the normal, even when it's acting up, even when it's not behaving in a normal way, or it's not providing the ecological services that it could. These are been degraded ecosystem services. And I really think that there's some really cool, innovative ways of valuating ecosystem services, which I do try to promote us doing, because even though it might not be the best way to evaluate ecosystem services by placing a price on it, I think it is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, water is going to be the new gold. I mean, it is in many, many places, right? It's interesting. My first book I wrote, I put a Cree friend of mine, his grandpa used to tell him, son, one day we're going to have to buy our water. And it wasn't even, my friend is in his 70s, and it wasn't even, he couldn't even imagine when he was 5 years old. But his grandfather, his Cree grandfather, had, the knowing that one day we were going to have to buy our water, and here we are.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll never know what it was like, when my parents were kids or my grandparents were kids, and what the state of nature was then or the ecological services it provides, which is sad to me. Sometimes I wish some of that could have been preserved. Who said it? I'm trying to think. I was just started reading a book. By William Cronin, Changes in the Land. The environment became a casualty for the quests for profit. And
So the
sometimes
story
I've.
we told ourselves was that this a commodity.
That's right. And
And
perhaps there is a good argument now that we should be valuating water. Oh, and that's a tough one because I don't want to think about water as a commodity, right? But it's not valuated as a commodity on the global market. When you buy a bottle of water, what you're paying for is the convenience to have the water in the bottle, paying for the bottle and the convenience of a bottle of water. You're not paying for the water. The water was pretty much free, and
Well, I think if we asked, I talked to a lot of my clients. I teach a lot of nutrition, and I say the first protocol for health is always hydration. And people just aren't hydrated. People are not cellularly hydrated enough to stay well. So I'm like, this is, and it's in my HEAL protocol, the first of the HEAL protocols, hydration and homeostasis. And what's really interesting, I explain the brain only has to be 2% dehydrated. And I've always had this spiritual question. I wonder if on some level we deny ourselves of water on some level because we're denying Mother Earth of her right. We're dehydrating Mother Earth. And on some level, on some deep level, maybe we feel we don't deserve to be fully hydrated ourselves. It sounds like a pretty far out there thought, but I think about it once in a while. Because
that's
I've seen
right.
a lot of dehydrated people.
I used to be an avid kayaker. I took sea kayak guiding courses, became an assistant sea kayak guide with all the certificates and everything. And one thing that we had to tell folks we were traveling with on kayaks was make sure to drink water. Because when you're out on the water, something about just being surrounded by water, people forget to actually drink it. They don't feel thirsty. And I thought about that. I really reflected on that because at home, I found myself not drinking water as much as I should. And I wondered, is it when I'm sitting at home, I've just got so much work, I'm on the computer, I'm depriving myself of water. And I think maybe it's because I'm not out in the sun. Maybe it's because I'm not in a comfortable place. I'm inside, I'm sheltered, and something, the internal mechanism, that instinct, you need to drink water, just isn't turning on for some reason.
Interesting. So another really interesting thought and possibility. And I think that there's definitely some truth in both of those, you know. And you know, it doesn't take very much dehydration for the thirst mechanism to shut off. I mean, it's a coping strategy. You know, we're very, it's that resiliency that we all have, resiliency of nature, resiliency of humans, resiliency of animals. But that resiliency can also, you know, be our worst enemy. Well, you're going to be doing a beautiful presentation on April 28th for VCOP 28, the convergence of the people, the stories we tell, the games we play, the stories we tell. And I'm wondering if you would just share with our listeners just briefly what you're going to offer. Thank you,
Yeah,
Corey.
reconciling with the past. Gosh, I read Jody Wilson-Raybould's book True Reconciliation, which was a really good book. It was a book that I found difficult to read, but it was really impactful. And Bob Joseph, in his book Indigenous Relations, he defined reconciliation as this process of learning and action. And Jody Wilson-Raybould expands on that and says it's a process of learning, understanding, and action. And I love that. And for me, reconciliation with Indigenous peoples is so important. And I think part of that, it's not just reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, it's reconciling with our past and the impact that we've had on the land. And when I think about North America, and how we've literally terraformed it to suit European tastes and preferences, it's a little bit soul crushing about wondering about what it was like. You know, as I wa wander through livestock pastures, find them simplified, the pang of remorse kind of grips my heart. I'm kind of haunted with visions of wild grasslands, once alive, rustling. With ground nesting birds teeming with wildlife, as described by early settlers. Henry David Thoreau, I think it was in Walden, he described his mourning of degraded ecosystems where wildlife wasn't what it once was by human activity. And he liked it. He likened it to a piece of real epic literature, one of the big great works in the world. And you finally have this opportunity to read it and you open it up and there's pages just torn out of it.
Wow.
I did just start reading Feral by George Monbiot about rewilding. And he uses this term in the first chapter of the book, ecological boredom. And that really resonates with me as I think about my journeys in the cattle pastures. But I also find that it, and as I'm struggling to articulate myself, I find it doesn't encompass the full spectrum of emotions I feel. As if ecological boredom is more like the end state, the numbness that sets in after I've been desensitized to the tragedies that paved the way. It's the suffering of the wildlife, the collapse of cultures deeply connected to nature, crumbling under the weight of European philosophies driven by power and greed. And it's the resilience of those who, despite everything, have managed to salvage some of those pieces, are now fiercely guarding them against the relentless capitalist motives that, I guess, perpetuate colonial views of natural resources. But these pastures, they're not just isolated plots of land with minor impact. We've lost 30% of our forests, 70% of our natural grasslands and shrublands to agriculture. The feeling that I get is not, it's not just ecological boredom, it's ecological injustice. It's a profound wrong. And I think having that understanding really orientates ourselves towards providing solutions for the future. And just as Judy Wilson-Raybould talked about reconciliation being a process of learning and understanding, we should listen to the stories about the land, what it was like, the stories that were passed down for generations. I think that learning is in part a historical journey about what led up to the landscapes that we now know and experience today. And part of my presentation will really kind of focus on that. And so I hope that intrigues our listeners today, and to think about how and why did we terraform North America to be what it's like today, and what could we do to change that narrative for the future, to align it with our values and continue our reconciliation journey, not just with Indigenous peoples, but with ourselves, because I think that we've lost that connection to nature, and that's something I want to bring back.
Thank you, Corey. And we shall or we will perish. And I think we shall. So I've only been on this earth 60 years in a couple months, and I remember a very diverse ecosystem, much richer than what I see. And it could just be I lived in a different environment in the Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario, where there wasn't much industry. But I think it was more than that. I've even seen it living in Alberta. I've seen the birds disappearing. I hardly see any birds anymore, honestly. A little bit more in the spring, but the frogs aren't even like they used to be 5 years ago. So it's an interesting time to be on the planet, but we're here because we're supposed to be, and we're going to all start telling a new story. We're going to tell a story of reconciliation and regeneration, but not that we don't need cattle for that. We know that. And rebirth, it's the rebirth of the butterfly, the chrysalis of knowing that we are here to fly, and we do not have to take part in something that has never been ours to inherit anyway. So thank you, Corey, very much for being here, and we look forward to having you on the Convergence.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. Thank you.